G'day, and welcome to Follow the Money, the Australia Institute's podcast demystifying the big economic issues in Australia and putting them in plain English. I'm Ebony Bennett, Deputy Director at the Institute, and today we're bringing you more guests from our Economics of a Pandemic webinar series. We are quite obviously in a global pandemic and one that has major global repercussions. The United Nations report on the world economic situation and prospects as of mid-2020 states that the world economy is projected to shrink by 3.2% this year. Under the baseline scenario, GDP growth in developed countries like Australia will plunge by 5% in 2020. And the projected cumulative output losses during this year and next year is supposed to be nearly $8.5 trillion, wiping out nearly all the output gains of the previous 4 years. And while the focus of most of our webinars has been on the Australian economics of the pandemic, we wanted to zoom out, if you'll pardon the pun, and take a more global view.
The International Monetary Fund says the coronavirus pandemic will cost the world's economies $9 trillion over the next 2 years.
And all countries need to work together to protect people and limit the economic damage.
But that there is massive support to the developing world not to let the disease spread like a wildfire in the developed world.
Millions of people do not have access to basic washing facilities, sanitation and hygiene. And many can't afford to buy hand sanitizer.
The United Nations is staging a conference that's talking about building back better.
We should bounce back better from this pandemic by investing in renewable energy, by driving clean cars,
making green investments to support economic recovery.
Global Green New Deal involves investing in renewable energy, a more energy-efficient public transport system.
And so the green recovery is an appropriate roadmap. So if we don't make the right choices, we will prepare for more catastrophes in the future.
We've got to have many horses in this race. Any horse that has a chance of winning, we've got to give them every bit of support we can.
Renewable energy is not just the cheapest, but also the cleanest way to renew an ageing, increasingly unreliable electricity system.
Today we were delighted to speak to the Chief Economist for the United Nations and Undersecretary General Elliot Harris. Elliot is the head of the United Nations Department of Economic and Social Affairs, which is supporting the world to contain the calamity and emerge from it more resilient and united. The department closely monitors the economic, financial and social impacts of the crisis and advises the UN Secretary General and member states in navigating the policy choices ahead in a way that leaves no one behind. Elliot is the Chief Economic Advisor to the UN Secretary General, and he has over 25 years of international experience in the fields of international economics and development policy analysis, and his experience extends to the design of macroeconomic policies and its application to poverty reduction and sustainable development. He also spent a number of years at the United Nations Environment Programme and the International Monetary Fund. So there are few people on earth who it's better to speak to about the global economic implications of the pandemic. Elliot is from Trinidad and Tobago, though usually he's based at the United Nations headquarters in New York. And he's joined in conversation today by Richie Merzian, Director of the Climate and Energy Programme at the Australia Institute. This was recorded live on Wednesday, the 12th of August, 2020, and things may have changed since recording.
Thank you very much, Ebony. Thank you for having me.
Richie, I'll hand over to you now for the first question.
Thanks, Ebony, and thank you, Elliot, for joining us here. It's a great pleasure to be able to host you on this Australian platform. You have the opportunity to oversee most countries' approaches to the pandemic, which I'm sure have been quite varied. But how important is it in having that view? How important is it to address specifically inequality and to ensure that there are the social protections to address the most marginalized parts of society so that we don't exacerbate broader problems in trying to address the immediate one?
Thank you for that question, which is a good kickoff. What we have found in looking at how the pandemic has affected countries is that it has managed to find exactly those weakest points in all of our societies. It is exacerbating the existing inequalities. Now, we've seen a mixed picture in terms of inequalities. We've seen inequalities among countries declining over the last 30 years, partly as a result of the trade that's been going on among countries. Within countries, on the other hand, it's been getting worse. And the income inequalities has built up deeper wealth inequalities. And those are compounded by group-based discriminations and lack of access to opportunity. What we've seen happen with the crisis that's on our hands now is that it's exacerbating it. We have people who can work from home, as I do, but others who can't, whose jobs have either dried up entirely or who have to go out and expose themselves to potential infection in order to earn anything at all. We have schooling going online, but not every child has access to the internet or has the necessary equipment at home. We have countries with strong public health systems that have been able to catch infections early and provide treatment. Others who can't, and we find that the death rates are noticeably different between countries that have an immediate response and those that don't. And you mentioned social protection. There are countries that already have strong protection systems, and these are countries that have been able to support their citizens in this very trying economic crisis, whereas others have had to introduce new social protection measures at great cost to their budgets, and sometimes without having in place the infrastructure to make sure that they don't leave anyone behind. And so there are really quite substantial differences in how individuals, how groups, and how countries are experiencing this crisis. And unfortunately, the consequence of all of that is a deepening sense of, a deepening reality of inequality.
I was going to ask, we're many months now into the pandemic, and at least in Australia, the government here is recalibrating and in some cases already beginning to lower economic support measures. What did the global financial crisis teach us about the need for the duration of support and fiscal stimulus measures in the wake of a recession?
Very important point, and it has to be one of the most important considerations in designing the recovery. In the global financial crisis 12 years ago, we found that almost as soon as the situation was starting to stabilize, when it became clear that it wasn't all going to explode, our governments moved into consolidation. They moved into a more conservative fiscal stance. They scaled back on some of the support measures that they put out. What that did, inadvertently, was slow the recovery and prevent it from being as broad-based and as vigorous as it might otherwise have been. And it's our view that in this particular circumstance, which is much, much worse than it was 12 years ago, it would be a critical shortcoming if, as soon as we start to see the beginnings of a recovery, we were to see governments shifting too quickly into consolidation mode. It's going to be very difficult to manage, yes, and governments are already incurring what one might call unmanageable levels of debt. But we do think it's very important for us to exploit any possibilities we have to maintain these stimulus measures for as long as possible so that the recovery has the time to take root.
Elliot, the Secretary General has been quite forward, Secretary General of the United Nations, Antonio Guterres, has been quite forward around what he recommends should be included and in some cases not included in recovery plans. And in his comments to the International Energy Agency, he stated that coal has no place in the COVID-19 recovery plans. Now, for Australia, as the world's largest coal exporter, the government is considering whether to, or has already previously, just let the catch up there. If you can hear me, I'll continue.
Yeah, we can still hear you, Richie.
Great. So what basically the question is, what role could fossil fuel production play as part of recovery plans, given the Secretary General's comments? And also, previously, you worked for the United Nations Environment Program. They produce a report called the Production Gap Report. That report shows that currently fossil fuel producers like Australia have plans to produce more fossil fuel that would blow out any carbon budget and blow out any chance of reaching our Paris Agreement goal. And so in trying to address both climate change and COVID-19 recovery, what role should fossil fuel production play? And should we be considering more direct measures to address this?
Rishi, I'm going to be as blunt as I possibly can here with this. We know what is driving climate change. It's global warming. We know what's causing the global warming. It is greenhouse gas emissions, primarily carbon dioxide. That comes from fossil fuels above all. And of all fossil fuels, coal is the most carbon intensive. It is also the least effective and efficient in delivering energy. And when we say that coal has no future in the recovery from COVID-19, We mean that we want to see a recovery that puts us more clearly and more firmly on the path to sustainability, to a sustainable future. We know that we will not be able to sustain life on this planet if we do not get a grip on climate change, and the time is running out. We have to be able to move towards a low carbon structure, and everything that we do from now on has to have that in mind. And consequently, when we talk about investing in new coal or expanding coal production, we are definitely saying that we are going to take a risk of not being able to halt the climate crisis, of not being able to stop the warming of the climate, and that we then run the risk of irreversible damage. The science is clear. There is no doubt that this is what will happen. And so consequently, although for a fossil fuel producing and exporting country like Austria, like my own country, this is a very tense situation full of trade-offs, the fact of it is that unfortunately, the world does not have the luxury of allowing itself to continue down the path of fossil fuels. And so our view in the United Nations is that we should make every effort to first minimize the carbon footprint that we have. We know we can't flip a switch and turn all the use of carbon off, but we need to prevent ourselves from going down a path that commits us to a higher carbon footprint than is absolutely necessary. And fortunately, we have alternatives that are clean, that are renewable, and that do not have a carbon footprint. And I think it's really important that countries bear in mind that we have to spend our time investing in things that have a future instead of in things that imperil our future. And this, I think, is a key point. And it is a very difficult trade-off, there's no doubt about it. But it is something that is going to be inevitable. And we have to act. And the quicker we act, the more gradual our transition can be.
I might just follow up on Richie's question there. And Richie, I've got a few notes from people that they're having trouble hearing you. So if you can just make sure your volume's turned up as much as possible. Just following on from Richie's question there, a lot of the focus in terms of policy and the debate here in Australia often focuses on coal-fired power, and not a lot focuses on the supply side policies in terms of our fossil fuel exports. And we've seen in recent years, particularly Pacific Island nations push forward the idea of a moratorium on new coal mines, or indeed ideas like fossil fuel free zones. Is there a role for those types of supply side policies?
Absolutely. I think we have to deploy all of the possible instruments to set the right sorts of incentives to make it feasible and remunerative to invest in clean and renewable energy, and less feasible and perhaps downright punitive to invest in the fossil fuels. I do believe that we know, I can't tell you, Ebony, at what point in time the last government on earth is going to ban the last coal-fired power plant. But I can tell you that that will happen, and it will happen in my lifetime, probably even before I retire. This means that we know that this is a technology whose time has come. It is finished. And so the question of new coal-fired power plants really has to be seen in the context of time. We can certainly invest money now in something that might generate a return for the next few years, but it certainly won't generate a return over the full potential lifespan of that investment. Is that the best use of our financial resources? My answer to that is clearly no. We could invest it in less damaging forms of fossil fuel if we have to stick with fossil fuels, but preferably we should be shifting all of those investments towards things that are sustainable, that we can continue to do in over time without endangering the very basis of our lives here on this planet. And this is a critical choice that all countries have to make and all investors have to make. We know that these assets will be stranded. There is no doubt in anybody's mind. Do we still want to invest in them? What is the economic rationale of that? What is the social rationale in that? And there is no environmental rationale for that. And so consequently, I think these are the things that we have to weigh when we make these kinds of decisions.
It's a timely question that you raise, Elliot, because just yesterday, the Senate here in Canberra was hearing from some of the government advisors about the need to underwrite or subsidise gas infrastructure to expand Australia's gas production. And Australia has recently become, you know, the largest LNG exporter. Now, most people who are familiar with Trinidad and Tobago might be more familiar with Brian Lara and Batsman. But really, the economy there is also heavily
involved in gas production and export as well. Do you think it's a good idea for Australia to be underwriting, for taxpayers to be underwriting gas infrastructure and expansion of fossil fuel production, specifically at a time like this, when there's also a glut in the gas market as well?
Well, I would ask myself, what sorts of incentives should policy set? Now, if we need to subsidize any sector, any form of economic activity, in order to incentivize the investment, then we need to ask ourselves, well, should we not incentivize investments that are going to serve us well for as long as possible? And that then comes back down to the question of, do we want to continue to invest in fossil fuels when we know that they don't have an unlimited future? When we know that every additional bit of carbon that we pump into the atmosphere is limiting our own future and our own capacity to prevent irreversible climate damage? I think the answer to that is pretty clear. Now, for countries like mine, like yours, this is a tremendous trade-off. But if we should go down the road of subsidizing them, one has to ask, well, why is the subsidy even necessary? Why is the private sector not willing to invest without the subsidy from the public purse? And the reason for that is that the private sector can think ahead. And they understand perfectly well that this is time-bound technology. It is limited. And anyone who wants to be making profit 30 years from now has to take into account what the climate is going to look like, or has to take into account what the overall environment is going to look like. And these are things that do not offer good perspectives from the point of view of fossil fuels. And so consequently, I think we really have to think about, how do we shift the flow of investment towards sustainability? How do we spend our money in the most sustainable way that has the longest and most favorable future for our ourselves and for our children? And those questions have to be answered.
So on the question of money then, is the issue in terms of, you know, because one of the goals of the Paris Agreement is to align finance with climate change. So is the issue in terms of financing our sustainable future, is it an issue of a lack of capital or a lack of political will?
Oh, quite clearly the lack of political will. My assessment is that although governments are indeed, in principle, committed to the sustainable development goals, they have not yet taken the step of changing policies to make the policies consistent with those sustainable development goals. And if you speak about subsidizing fossil fuels, clearly that is not consistent with SDG 13, which is on climate change. Now, what we've seen in this COVID crisis is that governments are indeed capable of really ambitious, rather unorthodox, and extremely important, even massive interventions when the stakes are high enough. Well, I can think of no stakes that are higher than the climate crisis that we're living in right now. And so here's the question. If we are going to make interventions, if we are going to make policy decisions, if we're going to spend public money, what should we be spending it on? And I think that that has to be one of the guiding questions for the recovery. Let's not go back to what we had before, because it wasn't enough. It wasn't generating the sustainable future that we all need. It was leaving large amounts of people, large numbers of countries behind. Let's go forward into something that is better, and we can correct the mistakes that we've been making in the past. And we have seen through the COVID crisis that when governments want to, they can act. And they enjoy the support of people because the people understand why they're doing it. And that's part of the equation. There are going to be losers. In any transition, there are always losers. Let us embrace that. Let us say, we understand that some of you are going to lose your jobs. Some sectors are going to go into decline. Let us see what we can do to make those transitions as acceptable, as manageable as possible. The just transition is the phrase we use for that. But let us not try to pretend that we can go back to what we had before and expect to have a better result. I call upon Mr. Einstein's definition of insanity. It won't work unless we change our policies. And we have to change our policies because it has to work. We do not have a choice.
And so, speaking of changing policies, the European Union's put forward a European Green Deal, which in a sense is trying to address both recovery as well as climate, as well as financing, as well as transition, to address, as you said, those who are less likely to benefit and those who are more likely. But the most interesting thing, I guess, for Australia, which is negotiating a free trade deal right now with the European Union, is this issue of border tariffs. And the potential for the European Union to put border tariffs on Australian goods that are high in carbon intensity in order to, you know, even things out, given that their own economy is now prioritizing greener or less carbon intensive goods. Are those type of policies useful to help shift things along? And are we likely to see more, especially, you know, if say, the US changes tact in terms of its approach to climate as well?
I think the fact that that is a part of the European Green Deal is indicative. Because if you think about it, the idea here is that we want to reduce the carbon footprint of our consumption and production patterns. Now, it does not help if in one country we've reduced the carbon footprint of our production and the consumption of those products, but we are also consuming products that are produced with a much higher carbon footprint, because that goes against the basic principle of reducing the footprint, the carbon content of our consumption and production. That's SDG 12, by the way, sustainable consumption and production. It's only consistent. You see? Now, whether or not that's the most effective way of handling it, I would say punitive taxes are always something that you want to leave as a last resort. It's always much better to discuss, to sit around a negotiating table, explain what the constraints are, explain what the objective is, explain how the difficult transition will yield eventually to a much better and much more sustainable future that is profitable, because I will say that renewable energy is profitable now, and to come to a mutual agreement on this rather than to have any one set of players imposing sanctions or barriers or some other kinds of hindrances to the free flow of goods and services. But again, one of the realities of our lives is that it's not always possible to move in lockstep across all countries on some of these controversial matters. And sometimes some countries are able to move ahead a little bit more rapidly than others can. But I think the fundamental question is, can a country consistently say, we commit ourselves to reducing our carbon footprint and we commit ourselves to doing what has to be done to reverse climate change, and still at the same time allow loopholes that keep the carbon footprint higher than it should be? And so that is a real question. And to the extent that we cannot see movement in the right direction that's appreciable, I think we are likely to see that those countries that are moving ahead are likely to look for other ways in which they can advance the agenda as well. Now, hopefully, as I say, we can all come to agreement and move forward in joint harmony, because harmony is always better than conflict. But the fact that it's a part of that program, a part of that initiative, is indicative.
So on the question of moving forward together, which is the ideal situation, it comes down to the question of cooperation at the multilateral level. Elliot, when we met last year, it was on the margins of the UN Climate Action Summit that the Secretary General put on in New York. And it shows the power of the United Nations to convene the world, to facilitate these actions. Even President Trump attended the climate summit after threatening not to. Unfortunately, the Australian Prime Minister did not, despite being in the United States. And so it's probably a two-part question. The first is, what is the role of multilateralism, and does it need reinvigoration, both on climate, on health, on trade? In all three, we've seen a fair few critics rise up and disparage multilateralism despite the real value. And then the second part is really like, and what is Australia's role in all that? Does Australia have a reputation as an honest broker, as a good faith player, or has the current administration's actions started to sour that?
Well, I do think that the multilateralism has been weakened over the last 5 years. Don't forget, this whole system, the Paris Agreement, the Addis Ababa Agenda for financing for sustainable development, and of course, the Sustainable Development Goals themselves, those were, if you will, the absolute summit of multilateralism. And I think that that was born out of a sense that joined up coordinated action is what enabled us to get out of that last crisis, the global financial crisis, without more damage. The G20 came together and acted together and really did prevent things from just slipping out of control. Now, we've lost sight of that. And I think part of it is because, on the one hand, we have had some downsides to this process of globalization, to the integration of the global economy. And I think there have been losers groups of people, for example, manufacturing workers in some of the industrialized countries, who've lost out to the offshoring of manufacturing production to other countries, to these long global supply chains that have arisen as a part of the globalization trade. We have not dealt with that. Our governments have not had open and honest conversations with their citizens to explain what is going on and what we can do to help people, to help groups manage this transition in a reasonably just and equitable way. But we should not lose sight of the fact that those multilateral processes have been very powerful. If you look at the history of trade over the last 40 years, I mentioned at the very outset that the inter-country inequality has been declining, and to a large part because due to trade, some countries have been able to catch up. Yeah? And you need only look in Australia's hemisphere, look at the experience of Australia, of New Zealand, of Japan, China, Korea, Taiwan. The list goes on and on, countries that have benefited from trade. But again, the question is, trade is not only positive, there is the downside as well that also has to be managed explicitly. On the other hand, where we don't have multilateralism working well, we have things like conflicts that we can't seem to solve. Look at Syria. We've not been able to come to an agreement on how to deal with it. And the human pain and suffering that that crisis has caused is indescribable. And so that is part of the issue. Many of the topics that we have to deal with as individual countries, they only have a multilateral solution: climate change, biodiversity, the regulation of artificial intelligence. We are going to have to come up with a jointly conceived framework within which national regulation for artificial intelligence can take place. We have to fight discrimination. We have to manage migration properly. We have to resolve conflicts. We have to try to protect our oceans. Look at what is happening to the Australian Great Barrier Reef. Yeah? That Australia alone cannot solve. It needs international cooperation. We have to find ways of taxing the digital economy, which is growing by leaps and bounds, and yet is escaping much of the taxation of national fiscal authorities. All of these are areas where we have to come together. It does not impinge upon a nation's sovereignty to cooperate with its neighbors. And we really have to make an effort there, because we would simply not do as well if we try to do it alone.
I want to go back to, I think, the first question that Richie asked you about, which touched a little bit more on fiscal measures to tackle inequality and provide social protection, particularly in times of crisis. And you've talked about how governments have been quite innovative and also willing to make quite bold policy pronouncements and agendas in times of crisis. One of the things I think this is really thrown up, particularly in Australia, but I'm sure elsewhere as well, is the way in which our workplace and industrial relations has changed to have much more workers on casual and short-term contracts, people without paid leave provisions, and that this type of insecure work, sometimes related to the gig economy, has actually turned out to be quite a threat to public health in a pandemic. But how important is it going to be to address some of those issues that have cropped up as part of the economic recovery?
I think it's going to be critically important. And here we have the opportunity now to set the framework that will guide the way things like the gig economy evolve over time. And I think this framework, we're not saying that every country must have the same regulation. That is unlikely and it may not even be appropriate. But I think we should have some sort of basic agreement on what principles, what values should guide the way we manage the evolution of the labor market. We spent 100 years developing worker protections. And those worker protections have started with, for example, the forbidding of child labor. Right, and I think we all agree that this is something that we should strive for. We're not yet 100% there, but it's something we should strive for. We all agree that the discrimination of women in the workplace has to stop. The glass ceilings is just bad economic policy, and it's even worse social policy. We agree on these principles, and those are the principles then that should set the framework within which the regulation of the new labor markets, the evolving labor markets, should take place. Now, we don't want to overregulate, because there is a lot of innovation that is happening. And as that innovation occurs, if it's channeled in the right direction, it can be beneficial to a lot of people who might otherwise be excluded from the labor market. But one of the things that we have seen is that with so much technology seeding into these kinds of new forms of work, that we should be ensuring that people are equipped to take full advantage of the technology and the innovations that are happening. This means that we have to be equipping our societies to provide lifelong learning opportunities to people throughout their careers, understanding that their requirements will change as rapidly as the jobs change, and the jobs are changing more and more rapidly as we speak. And these are things that we have to build up an understanding of. We have to decide to allocate resources to provide these kinds of lifelong learning opportunities. And we have to decide that this is a common good. It's a common public good that we all want to support. These are the ways in which we will manage, I think, to ensure that people can take advantage of the new opportunities that the more flexible labor market or labor markets, because there's no single market, that they will offer. But at the same time, we have to be aware that there are certain principles that have to be put in place, regulatory principles that can guide the development of these new forms of market in directions that are socially acceptable, if you will, and can avoid some of the downsides that we are already seeing in some manifestations of this gig economy.
Thank you very much. Richie, did you have any final questions before we go to audience questions?
Yeah, just one last one. And it comes down to, I guess, Australia's neighbourhood. So Australia has in the past championed more climate action, and it's often justified it in the interests of its low-lying small island developing neighbours, the Pacific. And so I guess the question is, to what extent does Australia play a role as a champion in this space? And has this changed? So more really, like, how has Australia been seen in the multilateral space, and specifically in terms of advocating for its region?
Well, I can say from what I see of the representation of Australia, let's say in the UN context in New York, that Australia is a very vigorous advocate for the Pacific Small Island Developing States and is seen as such by these Pacific Small Island Developing States. And as a citizen of not one, but two Small Island Developing States in the Caribbean, I can tell you that this is one of the major frustrations, is that although we have the same voice as any other country in the United Nations, we are small. We don't have that heavy weight of population or a large economy. And having a large champion is extremely important for the Small Island Developing States because it amplifies their messages. Yeah. And it allows them to, let's say, swing with a much heavier bat. And so we know that Australia, when it's in the G20, for example, has the situation of the Small Island Developing States of the Pacific in mind when it's talking to its G20 peers. That is something that no small island state on its own could ever hope to achieve. And from that perspective, this is a really important role that Australia and New Zealand, by the way, play in advocating for the interests of the Small Island Developing States, including in the climate arena. And this is really important for them because this is not just a problem of the future, it's an existential problem of today. And so I think it's really something that we have to support, and we have to encourage the Australian government to continue to do so, because it's really important to raise the issue of the Small Island Developing States and the neighbourhood in which Australia lives onto the global stage.
Thanks very much, Elliot. We might move now to questions from the audience. I can see a number have come in. And just a shout out to, I think we've got about 655 people participating today. Thank you very much for joining us from all across the country. I will just remind people, if you would like to ask your question live to the panel, use the raise your hand function and I'll come to you in a moment. But the first question I've got here is from Richard Bentley, and he says, leading energy companies like BP are pivoting to a carbon-free future. Should we encourage and champion these leaders and encourage all energy companies to follow their lead? And I guess more broadly, if you could comment on, we've talked a lot about what governments are doing, what's the private sector doing at the moment, but particular fossil fuel companies, how are they moving at the moment?
Well, I must say I welcome BP's decision to spend more time and more money looking at renewables and moving away gradually from this full dependence on fossil fuels. It's always going to be a difficult transition. It'll take time, but the earlier we start and the more committed we are to that transition, the better it is. And when a major oil company such as BP takes that step, it really makes a difference. It shows that this is a problem that affects us all and there's no way around it, and we all have to contribute to the solution. Now, I do think that this is something that governments can help with. And one of the ways they can help with that is through a clear and predictable policy. So assume for a moment, and I'm not speaking about any particular government, but assume a given government X were to say, in 15 years, we will have no more coal-fired power plants. In 15 years, we expect to generate 65% of our electricity from clean and renewable energy sources. That sets a very clear framework for the private sector to act. Right? They understand that, you know, this is something that the government is committed to, and it will put measures in place to ensure that this can happen. And that allows them to make the investments in these clean and renewable energy sources with a certain degree of confidence that they're not going to end up losing their shirts. And they also have a good incentive to move away from investing in things that have no future, such as the fossil fuels. This is one of the real weaknesses, I think, in government policy to date, that we have not had that clear and predictable definition of what policy is going to be and what the direction of policy is going to be without change. And if we get that, I think we will find the private sector moving in, because the private sector will take advantage of the possibility to make the short-term profit, yes. But more and more you find the private sector investors in particular, subscribing to the principles of sustainability, because they know if they want to be making a profit in 10 or 15 or 20 years, they can no longer afford to ignore sustainability concerns. And that is why we see ESG factors, the environmental, social, and governance factors, becoming more and more important, not just in the way individual enterprises are managed, but in the way in which investors make their decisions. ESG investing now has become a major force on capital markets, and that in the last 3 years alone, in recognition of the fact that all of us depend on this planet, and all of us have a vested interest in securing its future.
Richie, did you have anything you wanted to add to that?
Just more a question and a follow-on. So does it require, so to what extent do net zero by 2050 targets set that policy, or does it need to be more specific, say like Germany, that, you know, in sitting down and saying at 2038 there will be no more coal-fired power stations, or some government saying there will be no more coal mining after a certain date, a moratorium of the state? How specific do these policies need to be to give the private sector that kind of guidance?
I think if you asked any private investor, any manager, they would say the more specific, the better. Because for any private manager, it's a question of managing risk. And if you can remove a part of that risk by a clear policy statement, then that makes it easier for the private sector to manage the residual risk and to concentrate on making the right kind of investment that will be able to generate a return, because that's what private investment does. If it can't make a reasonable return and manage risk, it's not fulfilling its role. And so consequently, I think we can encourage the private sector to do what we know to be the right thing and what they know to be the right thing by reducing the possibilities for the wrong types of investments to generate a profit. And that is a role that government policy can play.
And I guess the role of the UN there is to facilitate that. And the venue would be, or the direction, the vehicle would be through these nationally determined contributions that countries need to decide on and then submit to the UN under the Paris Agreement, and then that becomes the clear basis for how they move forward. So given that 2020 is the year to update it, is there also a call then in addressing COVID-19 that you look to update your nationally determined contributions to help set that policy?
Well, yes, of course. I mean, that was one of the major outcomes of the Secretary General's climate summit last year. An exhortation to individual governments to, you know, make all and most ambitious efforts to update the nationally determined contributions. We put the UN system, including UNDP, including the UN Environment Programme, at the service of these governments to help them do the necessary calculations. But by the same token, at that climate summit, there was an appeal to certain key sectors that they too can make major contributions to reducing the carbon footprint. We think about transportation as one, energy, of course, is another, concrete was a third, buildings, and called upon decision makers in each of these sectors to look for the opportunities, even without government action, to look for the opportunities to reduce the carbon footprint, to provide a more sustainable way of conducting their business so that they too contribute. And it's not only up to what governments can decide and what governments have to incentivize. And I think that they will find, and we have seen progress happening, the reference to BP a few minutes ago is, you could think, a part of that. You know, that's exactly what we called for when we talked about the energy sector in the climate summit a year ago?
I hope you can hear me on the line there. Is it Joycely? Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yes, it is.
Do you have a question on anti-globalism that you'd like to put to the panel?
Yes. Good morning from Sydney. As we know, there's the rise of the nationalists. We can visualize the names and particular actions that have occurred recently, including the moves against WHO led by the US president. And concurrently, we have global issues such as, of course, climate change and the pandemic. Is it that so much depends on the November election of the USA that will determine proactive move of globalization, or are there, which means we are in hibernation for a number of months, or are there activities, actions that can be taken and by whom to be able to get us back on the right footprint across climate change and other important global aspects?
Thanks, Joycely. Cutting out a little bit there, but did you hear all of that, Elliot?
I think I got the gist of it. I do think that there is an awful lot that can be done by individual countries. And I think every country should do as much as it can on its own, regardless of what's happening in its neighbors, regardless of what's happening at the global level. Every country has a responsibility to its own citizens to do everything that it can with its own resources, with its own capacities. Every country also has an opportunity and an obligation to collaborate with others to try to carry the global agenda forward, because globally we can achieve a whole lot more than we can acting individually. Does that mean we have to wait for us all to be in absolute and perfect agreement to move forward? I would suggest no, we don't. I think we can work with those who are ready to move ahead. I think we can work with those who are still sort of trying to get the political consensus or to align their political allies to be able to move it forward. And I think we can also work with those who are facing real pushback or real difficulties in the domestic politics to try to find ways in which some form of contribution can be made. It may not be as much as we would hope. It may not be everything that could be done, but whatever can be done should be done. And I think that that is really important. Now, we've often heard talk about how we need to have everybody around the table. And I think that's very, very important. But I don't think that we should allow one or two absences to prevent us from reaching agreement where we can. And it's really important that we do this jointly, because the clock is ticking, and it's ticking with great speed.
Thank you. I've got, again, a Dr. Diaswati. I'm just wondering if you can unmute yourself there. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can, Ebony. Can you hear me?
Yes, just speak up a little bit. You're a bit quiet, but what's your question for the panel?
Hi, everyone, and hi, Elliot. I'm Chief Economist for PID and Colliers International. And my question would be, you first of all said about how COVID-19 has really deepened inequality and has really exacerbated inequality within a lot of societies. So my question as an economist would be, what is your recommendation in regards to addressing the deepening inequality as a result of COVID-19, particularly in terms of widespread economic fiscal policy that addresses homelessness, affordable housing, unemployment, things like that?
Well, I think the first thing we need to understand is how different groups are being affected differentially. For example, we know that there are a lot of people who can continue to earn their salaries by working at home. They are not the ones who require the kind of support that we're talking about. It is those whose jobs have been either totally constrained by the containment measures or who simply cannot earn enough because their industries are compressed. So, for example, anybody who's working in tourism. I think the first and most important thing is the social protection of these people individually so that they don't fall into destitution or back into poverty. That does require a basic awareness of who these people are, where they are, so that one can target the support measures. But it also requires that governments try to find measures that can allow small-scale enterprises in particular to remain afloat so that they don't close down permanently and totally destroy the jobs that they offer to people. So we've seen that being a major element in quite a few of the stimulus packages and the emergency response measures. They could be outright wage subsidies, tax relief measures that are given to companies. Also, government procurement can sometimes be directed to help maintain a certain amount of demand with these smaller scale enterprises. But these are things that are going to be among the most important measures for trying to prevent that people fall even further behind, because that is one of the major problems that we have. A second problem is that, of course, we do need to build up resilience for the future. And in those countries that did not have in place robust social protection measures, we found that it has been absolutely necessary for the governments to intervene with some form of social protection, for example, unemployment insurance, so that, again, this resilience is there. And our recommendation then is that that should be part of the foundation of policy going forward into the recovery, so that the situation you end up with after the crisis is one that allows for greater resilience as a matter of course, that is part of the structure of the way the economy and the society functions. But we also have to realize that there are going to be differences that can only be addressed by longer term policies. And one of the things that springs to mind is the question of the technological divide. We have the process of digitalization that has been tremendously accelerated by the fact that so many of us are working online. So much of our economy has moved online and no longer takes place in physical space. But we also know that the access to the internet, to the high-speed internet, is very unevenly distributed. We also know that not everybody has the access devices, the smartphones, that allow them to take full advantage of it. The whole internet of things that is evolving as we speak, the artificial intelligence that's changing the way in which production functions or production processes take place. All of these have the potential to leave a lot of people behind. Anybody who's on the wrong side of the technological divide is at tremendous risk of being left definitively behind and falling deeper and deeper into poverty. The inequality there is going to be massive because our societies are being increasingly digitalized and you know are so dependent on technology. This means that we have to be defining government policies in ways that address this problem. A, it's the infrastructure. B, it's the access. And C, it's the capabilities of people to take advantage of the technology. That comes back to the whole education system, the learning and the training that we have to make sure is available to all of our citizens, because otherwise we are condemning them. And there's no way around it. We will be condemning them to being second-class citizens if they don't have the ability to take advantage of the technology that's around us. Thank you.
Thank you. And we've got a couple of attendees actually complaining about their own internet connections and grateful that we're recording this. So just would like to repeat that for anyone having issues with connectivity today, this will be available on YouTube as a recording after the webinar. The next question is from Janet Hiller. She says the Australian government has set up a COVID recovery task force, which currently is focusing on gas investment as a driver of the economic recovery, and that it appears to have dismissed or belittled a green-led recovery. And she asks, what advice would you give, I guess, that and other task force looking at similar problems?
I think you need to take the time horizon into account. Are we talking about a recovery for 2 years, three? Or are we talking about a recovery for the future, for our children? And I will leave it at that. Are we going to invest our limited public resources in something that has a limited future, in something that we know is contributing to one of the major problems of humanity, if not the most important one? Is that how we want to spend our public money, or do we want to spend our public money setting the framework today for the future that we know we are going to want, and a future that will be sustainable for us and our children into the future? That's the question. It's as simple as that. And that, I think, is once you look past the short term, you start to realize that the decision factors start to look different if you take a longer term view. And I think we do have, any investment has to take a longer term view. And so I do believe that when we think about recovery, we have to realize any investment we do today, we're going to be living with it for quite some time. And so it's in our interest now to invest in as sustainable a manner as we can, so that we don't have to deal with the problems that unsustainable investments are going to give us in the future.
Mm.
Sorry, Richie?
I was going to add that there's also a personal agency there as well, because most Australians are actually invested in this recovery through their superannuation, through their pension funds, which is obligatory here in Australia. And the majority of Australians have it in a balanced portfolio, including some exposure to the Australian Stock Exchange, which includes a good number of fossil fuel producers as well. So there's an agency there in terms of actually changing your own investments through your superannuation, through your banking. And then the second part of that on these task forces, the other issue is transparency and accountability. And I know that you've raised this in the past, Elliot, how important it is that we also maintain accountability and transparency in recovering so that our institutions have the confidence of the populace to actually move forward and to invest down these directions as well. And that's been a real issue with this COVID commission. It has been quite secret. It hasn't released anything. The only thing we've seen is through leaked documents. And a number of our freedom of information requests have been blocked as well. I think there's certainly an accountability element to that too.
Yeah, that's a really good point, Richie. Our next question is from John Englert, who says, who asks, how widespread globally are economic recovery programs that are focused on reducing fossil fuel reliance and increasing the or accelerating the energy transition in accordance with the Paris Agreement? So obviously we've been very focused on what's happening here in Australia. Elliot, could you give us a picture on what globally are the emerging trends there? Are people looking to that green recovery as the way forward?
I think there's increasing interest in the green recovery as a principle. And the global Green New Deal discussion that has sort of gained a lot of traction, not just in this country, the US, but elsewhere, I think reflects that. I would like to point out that this is not the first time we're talking about a green recovery. I mean, 12 years ago, we had that. We in the UN had the global Green New Deal proposal we put forward. And some of the stimulus packages that were put in place at that time did have this element of green investment, not entirely and not as much as we would like, but it was a part of some of the country's stimulus packages. I do think that there is a greater awareness of that alternative course of recovery. There's much more awareness now that we can make decisions today that put us on a green path, that put us on a sustainable path, that put us on a low carbon path. What we need now are those policy decisions that actually translate that awareness into concrete policy. Right? We know what we need to do. The SDGs, the Sustainable Development Goals, provide that blueprint. We understand that we have to reduce carbon because otherwise the greenhouse gas problem remains there, the global warming remains, the climate change continues. The question is, how do we do it? How do we get the political will together to do what we know we have to do? And here's the problem. On the climate agenda, we know what to do. The technology is there. It's not perfect, but we can significantly reduce our carbon footprint today through the right kinds of investments. We need to foster that. We need to encourage that. We need to just do it. And what we need are government decisions that tell us this is the way forward. This is how our future is going to look. And that will very soon affect the ways in which private individuals make their investment decisions. And if we get that shift of the Titanic away from the old and the brown and the gray into the green and the new and the sustainable, I think everything is possible.
Thank you very much. Did you want to add anything to that, Richie?
No, we'll get another question.
So I've got here a question from Jared Everson Rose, who asks, can governments continue to oscillate between neoliberal policies during good times and verging towards welfarism during crisis events, especially in a world facing more frequent crises such as bushfires here in Australia or indeed a global pandemic?
Well, again, I think the idea of welfarism has a connotation, I think. One could think of it more as a question of resilience. We know that there are going to be shocks. There are going to be economic, environmental shocks. There may be social shocks. We want our countries, our peoples in particular, to be able to absorb these shocks, to not be thrown off into poverty, to not have destitution be the alternative to their lives today. The resilience can be built up through a range of different measures. We've talked earlier in the program about social protection. I think that's a critical element of it. I do think a clear sense of what we're trying to achieve in the recovery is not just getting back to growth as we used to have it before, but we want a different kind of growth. We want a growth that does not generate the kind of inequality we've seen over the past 30 years. We want a growth that is more sustainable, that does not have this resource intensity that we know is a huge problem. We want growth that is low carbon. Those are all elements of resilience. That's not welfareism. That is social progress, economic progress, environmental progress. It is the sustainable development that we have all agreed we want. Now, I think you're quite right that there will always be crises, and some of these crises are going to be happening with greater frequency and intensity, especially the weather-related ones, because of the climate change. And it's in everybody's interest that we are resilient, that we become more resilient to that. Also, it's in everybody's interest that we prepare for these kinds of impacts, these sorts of shocks, these disasters, so that they have less of a debilitating influence on our peoples when they do occur. This, I think, is something that is not a question of swinging between neoliberalism and welfareism and these other jargons and the heavily weighted connotations that kind of phraseology brings along. It's a question of pure common sense. Do we want to be vulnerable to the shocks in the future? Or do we want to be less vulnerable to shocks in the future? I think all of us will come out saying less vulnerable is better. Let's see what we can do to get there.
Thank you. And it's nearly time to wrap up. So I might just ask this final question. In a couple of minutes, would you be able to, is there anything positive that you think will come out of this pandemic and the way that we've rearranged ourselves and are looking for a path forward that you'd like to leave us with?
I think the thing that I would like to see happen as a result of this pandemic is the recognition by governments that people actually will support the right measures going forward. I think that we've seen that they've been able to do things that under normal circumstances might have been problematic, but they've done it under extreme circumstances and they've had the support of their populations and their electorates. I think they will find that if they can couch their policies in understandable terms and talk to their citizens and say, here is why we want to do it, they will find the support. And that will allow them to do a whole lot more than they think they can. And I hope that this pandemic proves that to all of our governments, that we don't have to hesitate about doing sustainable development. We should do it. And we will have the support because that sustainable development is in the interest of each and every one of us on this planet. And people will realize it. Thank you.
Well, we might wrap it up there. Thank you so much for your time today, Elliot Harris. We really appreciate it. And to you as well, Richie Merzian. And thank you to everyone today for your great questions. I'm sorry that we couldn't get to all of them.
This has been a special episode of Follow the Money, and we're aiming to bring you shorter but more frequent episodes during the pandemic, so please stay tuned. And if you're enjoying our podcast, please leave us a review. It helps other people to find us. You can visit tai.org.au for all our latest research and content and to find more details about our Economics of a Pandemic webinar series and to register. For the latest health information, you can check health.gov.au or listen to the ABC's excellent CoronaCast podcast, which comes out daily. And we're on Twitter at the Oz Institute with an AUS. My Twitter handle is Ebony_Bennett with a double N double T, and Richie Merzian is at Richie Merzian. This episode was produced by Jennifer Macy, and our theme music is by Jonathan McFeet from Pulse and Thrum. And remember, stay 1.5 metres away, keep washing those hands, wear a mask, and thanks for listening.